With our special report on the search for Bigfoot up next, Daniel Perez joins us. His work, Bigfoot Encounters Past to Present. So get ready for that. And welcome back. Daniel Perez founded the Center for Bigfoot Studies and started the popular Bigfoot Times newsletter, which he both edits and publishes. The newsletter, well known among Bigfoot investigators for its hard-hitting, sometimes controversial critiques of even the most prominent Bigfoot researchers in their work. Perez is considered by many to be an authority regarding the circumstances surrounding the 1967 Patterson-Gimlin film. And here's Daniel Perez on Coast to Coast. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hi there. My first time being on the show, so I'm real excited.
It's a perfect time for you too, isn't it?
I think it is. Right on the heels of the publication of a young adult book called Bigfoot Encounters Past to Present that myself and a fellow artist from Illinois illustrated, Stephen DeMarco.
Oh, that's exciting. You know, people of all ages are just fascinated, Daniel, with Bigfoot, aren't they? How come?
It's one of those mysteries that you don't think is really happening, but it really is happening. So it's like a double mystery to me.
What do you think Bigfoot is?
Oh, that's a good question. It's one that I think about not a whole lot because I don't think it's of consequence now. I think until something is actually collected, it's just like that's an open question. It's just like you'd say, well, maybe we have Neanderthal running out there or Gigantopithecus, mm-hmm. which is a popular theory. But in the end, it's just like until we actually have one, it's going to be an open question.
Some people think that the creature might be dimensional. Do you?
Throughout the years, that's come up. And it's just like over the years, there have been a lot of popular writers, especially like in the mid 1970s when there was a lot of these pulp magazines out there that
right.
kind of addressed that type of issue that said, well, it's a space traveler, it's interdimensional, blah, blah, blah. And my idea about that is it almost appears that we have something like that, but when you back up and maybe take a better look or a harder look, I think it's the rarity of the species that makes it almost appear like it's some goblin from another dimension. Take for an example like myself, I've been in the woods many, many times, but I've never seen a mountain lion. So although I know they exist, if I didn't have enough knowledge about the topic, I would say like, well, since I've never seen one and I hear about them, then maybe it's a space traveler. Mm-hmm. I'm making reference to mountain lions because of the rarity of species. And I think because of the rarity of species is that it almost appears that you've got something that's interdimensional or a time traveler.
Tell me about the Center for Bigfoot Studies, Daniel, and then we'll get into the search for Bigfoot.
That was in 1984. I founded the Center for Bigfoot Studies with the flashy acronym of CBS, but it really doesn't mean anything, and I've emphasized this over and over. The Center for Bigfoot Studies is largely just a holding tank of information by way of physical files, electronic files, newspaper clippings, and book files, a library. And it's just like, it is probably one of the largest ever assembled here in North America.
Now, when they say that sometimes it's controversial, what do they mean by that?
Meaning, what are you referencing to?
I mean, it's parts of the your investigations and your newsletter and your information. It's pretty controversial sometimes. You go after people if you have to.
Absolutely. It's just like we try to get everyone to toe the line. And just recently, last year, September, October, we spent 2 months on the issue of the Skookum Cast. And I said, well, it's been 10 years since September of 2000 that discovery was made in Washington State. One of the finders was, Derek Randall's from Washington State.
All right.
So I invited him. I said, would you be willing to be interviewed for this discussion about the matter? And so we gave him more than the four-page format of the newsletter. We gave him just more than four pages. We went into the next edition from September to October to let him have his say, so to speak. And after we finished with him in the October edition, we had quite a few people who had the opinion that the Skookum cast did not represent nothing more or nothing less than just elk in that part of the country. And so when that was also put in the newsletter for balance, Derek Randall said, well, something to the effect that, it seemed like it played out just perfect to your agenda. Please don't get in touch with me anymore. So that was the end of that.
Wow.
And it's just like we gave him the opportunity to speak his mind on the matter, and it's just like when things didn't go necessarily his way, then that's when things kind of fell apart.
Daniel, the frauds have got to really upset you.
Yes, and in fact, less than a week ago, I guess, this North Carolina video where this individual was driving across the road, and it's just like, several people emailed me, and I kind of put on my thinking cap, took one look at the video, and I said, I don't even want to hear the interview with the individual. It's just like, you can plainly see what you're seeing there is just a costumed individual.
And you'll go after people like that. I mean, we do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just like, that's why to the general public here in the United States, it's just like they just look at the whole matter as something akin to the Easter Bunny, a waste of time, a mythology, folklore, fantasy, just something, a subject to have fun with. And it's just like something better on the cover of National Enquirer than National Geographic. And so because of that, it's just like everyone thinks it's just a big silly joke.
So far, Daniel, what do you think is the best evidence out there that proves the existence of this creature?
Oh, Running Away, in my opinion, was the film shot by the late Roger Patterson in October of 67. And Roger's since gone, but Bob Gimlin is still living and just an incredible witness. And in the sense that he's never changed his story about what happened from his initial major interview with Jack Webster, which was like late September, early October of 1967. And, you know, it's this extraordinary thing that happened. And, you know, it's been 40 some odd years and he's still saying that this is what happened. And that's basically it.
What do you think that creature is that's on that film?
Wow, again, that would require speculation, but in terms of, you know, whether we're looking at a Bigfoot or whether we're looking at a man in a costume, and, you know, Bob Hieronymus is the most likely candidate for being the man in the costume for those people in that camp. It's just like, I've investigated not just the film, but the film site, the circumstances surrounding it, and created a massive bibliography just on the primary sources on the PG film, the Patterson-Gimlin film. And I'm absolutely convinced that what you see there on that strip of film, the 953 frames, is Bigfoot.
And tell me, what did you mean by Bob Hieronymus could be the candidate?
Bob Hieronymus as of late 1999, he was, a Yakima newspaper writer put him out there as making the claim that he was the guy in the costume. And something like that could have been potentially very important had it emerged, say, like in 1968 or 1969, because it's Bob Hieronymus, who lives walking distance from Bob Gimlin in Yakima, had that claim came out, say, in 68 or 69, and he went to the newspaper and said, well, what you see that's unfolded in the Associated Press and the UP and on television, etc., is not Bigfoot, but that's just me in a costume, because he made the claim that Roger Patterson would pay him $1,000 U.S. currency to do that stunt. Now, in 1968, $1,000 was probably more than what people made in a month, a normal U.S. worker. And here he got gypped out of that $1,000, and it seems like he should have cried foul back then. And when you start to do digging, newspaper archive digging, etc., it's just like, it's just not there. It doesn't emerge till about 1999. And so I would say, I said, you can't be a Johnny come lately and jump on the train and say, like, oh, I was the guy in the costume. And by the way, he's not the first and not the only individual who claims that he was the guy in the costume.
Which really taints the whole thing in terms of, I'm not saying taints the authenticity, but taints the people who believe that it was a fraud.
Right. Absolutely. And it's just like, another thing that most people don't realize is that prior to May of 2009, a fellow by the name of Bill Munz that lives here in Hollywood, that's part of the Hollywood community of special effects, started taking a better and deeper look at that movie film in terms of trying to determine how tall the subject is. And by doing that, he used something that is almost in, that would have to hold up in the court of law, because in terms of simple mathematics, say like 3 + 2 = 5, that will always be, you know, if you have 3 + ? = 5, it's always going to be 2. So Munz used the optic formula that is used widely used in photography to determine that the subject that you see in that film, that close to frame 353, that the photographer, videographer, filmographer, Roger Patterson, was approximately 100 feet from the subject matter, where they call it the look-back sequence. And at about that distance right there, using that optical formula, that subject is roughly 7'3", and there's a plus and minus variance as to, okay, it might be an inch taller, inch shorter, etc., but it's got to be locked into that height. And Bob Hieronymus does not even approximate that height. And just backing up a minute, in May of 2009 in Yakima, they had the Bigfoot Roundup in honor of Bob Gimlin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up to be part of that event. And also when I was up there, I said, well, I've been to Yakima a couple of times, but I said, most people know my personality that I would maybe not challenge, but I said I was curious enough to find out exactly how tall Bob Hieronymus was. So I'm 5'7" tall. So I went to his home, knocked on the door, and out emerges from the side door was Bob Hieronymus, and he was at best maybe 5'10", at best. Now, this is an older individual, and say, like, maybe in 1967,
he stood up a little.
Maybe he was 6 feet tall,
yeah.
But he was not the 7'3" tall that was required to be in that epic movie.
And clearly this creature was walking with the strength of its feet. So it wouldn't be like it was on little risers or anything like that.
No, all that business about arm extensions and about wearing slippers and having pillows in the buttocks, it's just like when you start to really look at that film on a frame-by-frame basis and the careful scrutiny that Bill Munns and Dr. Jeff Meldrum have done, it's just like you're seeing something that is very unique in the sense that it appears that everything is what you see is what you get. You're really seeing a foot there. You're really seeing a hand there. You're really seeing a fleshy, massive buttocks from the behind and not a pillow in a costume. Because the pillow in the costume and everything else, it would be very discernible in a costume. And when you look at that piece of film and it's just like, that subject matter does not have the look and feel of a costume, because a costume, if anything, would conceal rather than reveal the muscle masses that you see moving in the movie film.
What's going on with any potential DNA work, Daniel?
I guess David Pilates and I want to say the NABS, North American Bigfoot Society or whatever, is they're trying to get this DNA analyzed to be unique and different than modern man. And it's just like, stop right there. It's just like, if you back up to the late Eric Bechtjord, who collected blood samples from the Lummi Indian Reservation from the mid-1970s, he was actually one of the first people to start a line of thinking along the ways of trying to have some DNA blood analyzed. And he actually was somewhat scientific about it at that time, hoping that you could do this type of study and come up with results that are unique and different than Homo sapiens. And it's just like, back then, he was not conclusive in any of his findings. So I suspect that any findings that they produce from 2011 even forward is again going to come back inconclusive or different than modern man, like hair samples that have been analyzed. But it's just like, it's not going to resonate with the scientific community in North America, because the DNA sample is going to say like, and they said, well, you can't fake this. And the late Grover Krantz, when they had in 1982, when there was a major or semi-major press conference with regard to the ISC, the International Society of Cryptozoology, right, and the dermal ridges that were found on some plaster castings that were associated with Paul Freeman, Krantz said something to the effect that even if these plaster castings were found in a New York garbage dump, that it would be impossible to fake these dermal ridges. And it's just, there again is a matter where it's just like, it didn't hit home. It did not resonate with the scientific community. They didn't all say like, oh my gosh, he's right. And it's just like, we should go jump on the bandwagon. And it's just like, it was just another event that just quietly went away. So with regard to any DNA stuff, it's just like, and the stuff that was also collected, I guess, from the Monster Quest episodes, I guess, they did some stuff like that, collected from an area in Canada. I can't think of the name. But there again, it's just like, even though you might be coming up with stuff that might be unique or different than modern man, it's just like, it's not a defining piece of evidence in the sense that people are saying, oh my gosh, this is it, we told you so. It's just like, it seems that what it's going to take is the carcass of a body.
All right, stay with us, Daniel. We're going to take phone calls and continue our discussion to get some more of the great stories you've got on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman talks with us about his work When we come back, we'll take your phone calls with our guest, Daniel Perez, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Daniel, outside of the Patterson-Gimlin film, what case do you see as one of the best?
Oh, the one that happened November 17th of 2005, that was also the photos of the subject that was up on Silver Star Mountain was on your website then, Coast to Coast. And that was the matter of Randy Chase. And when that happened, I saw the BFRO website, and I guess those photos were shown on several websites or a couple of websites. And I was immediately impressed by the images. So without even trying to get a hold of the witness, by 2006, I had driven up to Silver Star Mountain from the north side and came in I said, I'll figure out where Silver Star Mountain is and just go and have a look for myself. And that whole area is very impressive. It's prime Bigfoot country. And so when I got back home, I didn't meet the witness at the time. I didn't find the correct location at the time. And then by, I guess, Christmas of 2008, somewhere around there, Cliff Barackman was at my home, who's a well-known Bigfoot investigator from Washington State, had stopped by. And he was in my home office, and we were just chatting about things, about certain cases, talking about stuff, Bigfoot-wise, and I said, well, it sure would be interesting to know who RC was that's mentioned on the BFRO website. And for those people who don't know, BFRO means Bigfoot Field Research Organization, Field Researchers Organization. RC was the initials for Randy Chase from Washington State. And so that's what Cliff told me. And I said, do you have his contact information? Because I want to interview him. And so unlike a lot of what I would call dragon paste Bigfoot investigators that only do their work via the internet and a website, it's just like I do get out in the field and I do interview people. And so when Randy consented to be interviewed by me, I phoned him and I said, well, I want to ask you about these photos, blah, blah, blah. What were you doing up there? And he said it was a hike up in this country and something that he did often. And that when he made this hike, November 17th of 2005, he had asked a friend of his to go up. And the temperatures, the weather conditions were absolutely frigid, I think in the early 30s. And so he gets up to the summit of this area and he's something that he had hiked before in different types of conditions in the summer, et cetera.
So very familiar with the area.
Right. And so he says he gets up there and he sees this big rock that was out of place and it starts to move. And so his first reaction, he has now this is in 2005, but even then he had, correct me if I'm wrong, I guess a 3.2 megapixel camera, which even then was a kind of a dated type of digital camera.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's still a very functional camera. And so he pulls this out of his day pack and takes, correct me if I'm wrong again, but two shots of the subject that show motion. And then the third shot, and I had to ask him about this, is of the Columbia River. And I said, I can't imagine that in the heat of the moment that, you know, you're taking your eye off the ball to just take a shot of the Columbia River and not keeping your eye on the ball, the subject that's moving that you have no idea what it is. And then the third shot of the thing parting away. So it's subject, Columbia River, then the subject again. And when you blow, I think it's either one or two, when you blow up the digital image very big, you see the profile of the subject, which looks remarkably like a silverback, a gorilla in profile. And it's just like, so when I was up there in May of 2009, in Yakima. I had arranged immediately after the Yakima event to go see Randy Chase, and I said, would you be willing to go up to the mountain to show me where everything took place? And so one of my first experiments, and he agreed to do that, so we made a hike up there. And so one of my first orders of business was to see, like, at that distance, which was one of the arguments that it was just some guy hiking up the mountain from the opposite side who was just all dressed in black, like a skier or whatever, but all black clothing. And so I had Randy Chase as my test subject, and I put him where the subject was seen, and I was standing where Randy was, where he got these photos, within in the immediate rough vicinity. And it was very clear with the naked eye, with my camera, with his camera, that clothing was easily discernible. So even if there was black clothing or black jacket on top of a black shirt, that you would have been able to discern that. Because with Randy, it was like there was no question about it. But when you see his images, there's not a hint that there's any layered clothing or anything, just a very dark image. And I think, you know, after talking with him and spending a day with him, I'm very impressed with him as a witness and by his images. And he just doesn't have that. He's an electrician by trade, the same as me.
He doesn't have that fraud persona, does he?
And he doesn't have the electrical technical know-how to do anything like that. He's just not that type of individual.
Let's go to the phones. Daniel, Tom's telling me that someone saying that she's Leslie Patterson from Kennewick, Washington, on the line. So let's go to Leslie, first of all. Sure. Hey, Leslie, how are you?
I might have to call back. I think I'm losing the battery on my phone.
You've been on hold for a while, haven't you?
Yes, my father-in-law was Roger's brother. It was a big rodeo family. And I saw the thing about Bob Hieronymus one time, and they know all these, you know, any cowboy, because Lester provided stock for all the rodeos. And I asked my husband if he'd ever heard of a fellow named Bob Hieronymus, and he said he'd never heard of the guy.
Tell me about the film. I'm sure you've seen it quite a bit, Leslie. What do you think?
I just still find it so astounding that after so many decades, it's just nobody has definitively been able to tell.
But you think it's authentic? Her phone.
I would lean that way. I mean, it's around the family. You do not joke about being the guy in the suit, for sure.
No, not at all. Not at all. Leslie, I'm going to put you on hold, and I want you to give Tom your phone number. We'd like to get you back on another program, if not later on today, Daniel. But small world, Daniel Perez, isn't it?
Yes, that's interesting to hear her voice, relative of the Pattersons there.
Next up, we go to Thomas in Cleone, California. Hey, Tom, thanks for holding.
Oh, hey, thanks for waiting for me. You know, it's really an honor to be on after Leslie Patterson, too. And Daniel, I really appreciate what you're doing. You know, I've got a question about what Art Bell originally brought up, that he was afraid that the first Bigfoot encounter would be a dead Bigfoot. And you mentioned a... people thinking maybe these were cougars. Some friends of mine in Albion thought that they may have heard a Bigfoot, and they said, no, it was not a cougar. We had a story in the news tonight about another cougar being shot, and the cat was a female 100-pounder, just afraid in somebody's backyard, which I contend, you know, that's really their living room where we build these houses. And if there's an injured Bigfoot somewhere, I'm concerned that fish and game, fish and wildlife, the law enforcement people might come out and end up shooting the animal, the creature, for public safety purposes. And it seems to be so close to us, that would be absolutely tragic. Is there some way that the professionals that are researching this, the scientists, could maybe put together the BFTF, the Bigfoot Task Force, and maybe the Coast audience could support a protocol where if a situation arises where one needs to be dealt with, that it could be tranquilized? We tranquilize elephants, and your careful calculations indicate to me that there should be some way to formulate a safer way to deal with one of these creatures so it doesn't have to die and could be, you know, if it was injured, could maybe be medicated and then healed by a veterinarian.
Well said, Thomas, and that's one of our fears. As a matter of fact, about a year ago, I got a call from a ex-Marine who said he was going out there to shoot one. I hope I talked him out of it, Daniel. On one hand, you know, if you're being attacked, you got to defend yourself. But generally, as I was telling Jeff Meldrum earlier, they don't show any signs of being aggressive to humans, do they?
No. In fact, let me back up just a second. Just a shameless plug for the Sasquatch Summit, which is going to happen next month in honor of the work of John Green. And just so some of the cryptozoologists and the people who study Bigfoot, Green was mentioned in Ivan Sanderson's book in 1961. And there's not another person on the planet living that can make that distinction. His work has spanned over 50 years. And in his database of work, there's really the percentage of aggressive behavior on behalf of Bigfoot is less than 1% of the overall reports here in North America. But addressing the gentleman's question more specifically, in terms of a distressed Sasquatch, and there's people in the area, you could only wish that could happen. It's just like no one on the planet to date can make an appointment with the Sasquatch or Bigfoot. And it's just like I've yet to hear an example of anything like that where you have a Sasquatch that's incapacitated or something to the effect where, you know, you could, instead of shooting it, you could come out and rescue it, so to speak. It's just like we could only wish that could happen. And you know, when Mount St. Helens blew in May of 1980, it's just like there were a lot of rumors that came from that time about, you know, that Bigfoot was in need of help, blah, 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 and they brought these black unidentified helicopters in, and they collected carcasses, they collected live specimens, et cetera, et cetera. But then again, you have to look at that with a very critical eye, and it's just like, forget the anecdote, forget the story, show us the proof.
All right, let's go to Rich in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He's been on hold almost an hour. Rich, go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
Good, Rich. Thank you.
I just want to bring three things to the table here. One, could people be scared when they see the Bigfoot or have a suspicion that maybe a Bigfoot is there because of the fear of the unknown?
Sure, absolutely.
And two, maybe the Yeti and the Sasquatch and the different variations, or maybe a different, like the animal adapted to its environment instead of being different species. Maybe it adapted. Is that possible?
What do you think of that, Daniel, that we're talking about the same creature, but it's changed a little bit because of wherever it is?
Yeah, it's. I would say that's a possibility that what you have, say, on the Asian continent could be the exact same thing here in North America, but is adapted to its environment and possibly turned into a different species, if you will. I don't, it's possible, but again, it's just like, for me, that's thinking outside the box in the sense that it's a complete non-issue. It's like, well, you can continue to debate and question that piece of information for a long time, but you'll never know until you have a specimen or a blood sample or something like that to actually do some really detailed studies, whether it's the same thing or a different species.
Okay, and how about your last question there, Rich?
Could it be possible that the sightings and they're not finding a carcass or anything like that could be maybe they're a nomadic species?
Of a what type of species?
Like they're nomads?
A nomadic species. Yes, I would go for that. And it's just like, it's just, again, those are questions. It's just like, if someone were to ask, and I've been researching the problem for, since about 1973 from when I got involved by the movie, The Legend of Boggy Creek. And it's just like, all I can tell you is that I have more, I don't know, to the question rather than let me tell you what I think. And in terms of like finding bones and stuff, why we're not finding it, et cetera. It's just like, I don't know.
Let's go to Abilene, Texas. We've got Olivon with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Olivon.
Hi, sir. Good show tonight.
Thank you, sir.
I got interested in Sasquatch because I seen Legend of Boggy Creek, too. That's when I first got interested in it. But in 1989, me and my wife was going home from Odessa back to Seguin, and we got in Big Lake, and it was real late at night, and we were both sleepy, and she says, well, I won't count, let's count deer eyes on the side of the road. I said, all right. So we started counting. We counted about four of them, and I rushed down in the floorboard, and I was messing around in the floorboard for something, and I heard her say, there's a deer, and I started raising up. And I was raising up, I was looking at this creature, and I said, that ain't no deer. She said, that's a bear. I said, no, ain't no bear either. And we passed it. She just pushed out on the gas, and we spun past it, you know, and I kept telling her, stop, stop, stop. I guess she stopped about a mile after we passed it. And I said, go back. I want to see what that was. And she says, no. And I had goosebumps all over my legs, my arms and everything, and I told her, I said, you know what that was? And she said, what? And I said, that was a Bigfoot. And when I got home that night, I went to sleep, and I had a dream about what we saw, and it was everything all over again. It was a slow-motion dream. And when I looked up, I seen the same thing, but I seen what it was carrying. I thought it was carrying something hairy, but it was holding something hairy, and it was a blondish-looking color. And it was a female, I guess, that was holding it, and she had her head buried in his chest. But when I got to Ozona that night, before we got home, I told the police, I made a police report about it. And it was back in October of 89. And I made a police report about it, and they wrote it down. I just told the people, I didn't want to tell them what I saw was Sasquatch. I just described what I saw. And they said this, that, and that guy looked at the man, he goes, well, sounds like a Sasquatch sighting.
Yeah, they're probably pretty used to that. Daniel, there was a call I had about a year ago. Individual was fishing. He caught a couple fish. He said he came face-to-face with a Bigfoot, and the creature was looking at the fish, so he figured, uh-oh, I better give it to him. He handed them over to him, and he said that the creature looked at him, gave him one back. I don't know, but that tells me there could be some intelligence here.
Yeah, I mean, a report like that, it's just like, that's interesting. That's interesting because it's just like when you're confronted with first something that's on the edge of reality, and then to hear a story like that where the subject has taken the fish, gave you one back, it's just like it borders again on the unbelievable, but it's just like, why couldn't something like that have happened?
Absent. Daniel Perez, thank you so much. Daniel's website is part of our coasttocoastam.com. On our Twitter feed, you'll find some pictures that Daniel was talking about posted there. Lex has them there for you already. And I will be back in a moment with Lauren Coleman, cryptozoologist on Coast to Coast AM.